Good evening and welcome back to Ulcerative Colitis Motherhood and Me. I'm Ulcerative Colitis Mama, and yes, I do realise it's been a couple of weeks since I last posted any content, so apologies once again. As usual, life, work, everything just sort of kind of takes over. And like I say, it's usually my most common excuse, is just trying to find sort of content really to share without sounding too mundane or boring or repetitive or any of the above. So tonight's episode, I know I usually start with a bit of a topic and a theme and then I kind of go down a bit of a rabbit hole. There's a few things that I've wanted to that have crept up over the last few weeks that I wanted to sort of discuss, and I think a lot of it is around sort of insecurity. So I wanted to obviously, as always, a lot of my content does involve mental health, and just sort of things that can cause some people, it can be a little bit triggering for some people, and depending on where you are in your recovery journey with your mental health, it can sometimes you don't want to be reminded of it. So I always give people the opportunity, before they go delving into my podcast episodes, that to be aware that I do discuss things like low self-esteem, certain issues, past traumas, things like that that can affect people. So and I, of course, being a huge advocate for mental well-being and mental health, that would be the worst thing I could possibly do, and I wouldn't want anybody to feel triggered by any of my content, even by accident. So without further ado, let's get started with tonight's episode. So yes, welcome back. I'm back again from another few weeks off. So basically what's new with me, I'll just kind of give you guys an update really on what I've been up to. So of course I've got this new job coming up, so that's been filling me with, well, mostly with excitement, if I'm quite honest. The change and things and just sort of that, looking forward to sort of career progression things. But as it's gotten a bit closer, so last couple of weeks I've put in my notice, so like effectively my resignation, my current job, which seems really, really formal and quite scary. It also seems very final, and I've spent 6 years, just over 6 years in my current job. So, that's a very long time, and and as cliched as it sounds, the people I work with have become family in that time, and we've been through so much together. And if anybody reads sort of any of my earlier content, whether it's on my blog, whether it's on my social media platforms, or whether it's even on here, my recovery kind of, I was very much a different, in a completely different headspace 6 years ago. I was still very much in the throes of it. And I'm, and it might sound a little bit, I don't know whether it sounds like the correct thing to say, but I'm incredibly proud of myself for that, for how I've kind of, my story arc has completely changed, and how I feel that I'm in a much safer space now, that I'm able to talk freely about my experiences without feeling triggered or panicked or anything that I used to feel, that I'm able to hopefully use my experience and, and that sort of past to hopefully help other people. And that's basically the very ethos, the very crux of this Ulcerative Colitis Motherhood and Me platform. That is the one thing that I aim, if I can, even if it's one in a million people that I can help, that is basically that would make me incredibly happy and fulfilled for that. So 6 years in the same job is, pretty good going, and especially in healthcare, because times move on, and one of the one advice I got from a very senior nurse way back when I was a third year student about to qualify, was she turned to me, and she was quite a stoic kind of gal. She was what they call an SEN, which was a state enrolled nurse, which was basically they unfortunately it's not a thing now. It was basically nurses that were qualified slightly differently, sort of pre-degree level, pre-diploma level. And so a lot of these nurses have sadly retired now. And she turned to me and she basically said, if I could give you one piece of advice, is keep moving around, get as much much experience as you can, and like your world's your oyster essentially. Because she had been in the same job since she qualified as a nurse, so since she got her wings, basically, she had stayed in the same department, the same speciality, and she'd never seen outside those that ward, basically. So she only ever knew one type of nursing. And I kind of took that on board, and I felt, you know, as scary as she was, she there was obviously some element of truth in that. And you know, and I wanted to get out, you know, there's a big wide world out there, and I wanted to get as much experience, as much knowledge and skills that I could as a 20 something year old, you know, student nurse waiting to qualify. So I, you know, and I have, this is sort of the this will be my fifth post as a registered nurse, so which isn't a lot really, you know, five, you know, changing jobs sort of five times, you know, I've been qualified a while. So qualified in like 2010. So you know, that's what, nearly 13 years. And you know, so five jobs in that space of time isn't really an awful lot, but they've been so different from each other, it's unreal. So, and going into a role like this one, so for those who haven't joined on my previous episodes, it's basically a specialist nurse role, and I am so stoked that and honoured basically that they picked me. I'm just saying my competition must have been absolutely horrendous, but no, you know, as you know, somebody who considers themselves a bit of an underdog, you know, it's a hell of an achievement for me, and I'm really looking forward to it, and I feel like the current sort of my soon to be colleagues who have been in the role for, you know, donkey's years, since, you know, since the dawn of time, I feel like I could learn so much from these people, and they're so inspiring. So I'm really, really looking forward to that. But as, like I said, as time's ticking on and I'm getting closer to my contract ending with my current job and starting this new one, I'm starting to feel quite sad. And it is, I suppose, it's the nostalgia, it's the, I've never been so close to a bunch of women and men, there's a couple of guys as well. I've never felt so included in all the years that I've, you know, worked in healthcare and nursed and things. I actually felt like I'd found my place. And as somebody, like I say, you know, I describe myself as an underdog, and I do, and I'll explore that a little bit further along the line, but I felt like I'd found my people, my fellow weirdos, you know, shining our little weird lights to each other, and you know, people that share the same sense of humor, people that you can laugh even in the most horrendous times, that you know, we've gone through, you know, the pandemic and everything together, and you know, we've seen each other get married, have kids, you know, sort of awful things happen, bereavement, loss, divorce, you know, all massive life milestones and life events. And we've stuck by each other the entire time. There's been no hatred, no jealousy, no bitterness. There's been nothing amongst our little group. And you know, I'm never going to get that again, ever, wherever I may go. And we were so united in that. And it's going to be really sad to go from, you know, essentially leaving home and leaving my family to, you know, pursue this career in specialist nursing. You know, it's You know, and I know it's such a massive opportunity, and it would be, I would be, have been an idiot not to have applied for it, because I'm very much a believer of you can only regret the things you haven't done. And I would have regretted not applying for this role. And the thing is, I wasn't to know that I'd get it. You know, I had as good chance as anybody else, I guess. But, you know, I there's always this kind of underlying thing in any sort of job where you think, oh, they've already got somebody lined up that they want. They're just got to go through the relevant, you know, hoops and red tape to do it properly. And it was a pretty intense interview, and I thought, oh, you know, I gave it the best I've got, and I thought, you know what, it's good interview experience if nothing else. And lo and behold, I get a call from my new, you know, matron to say, yeah, we want to give you the job. And I actually did say, oh my God, really? And I do mention that on my previous episode, so I'm not going to kind of repeat everything that I did in my last episode. Anyway, so that's kind of going on at the moment, and you know, I've kind of poured myself into being so excited, getting myself a new name badge and you know, new little notebooks and stuff, because I'm going to be following my colleagues around like a puppy and learning everything I can off them. And you know, and in a way, it's going to be like coming home, in the sense that it's the hospital where I trained, it's the hospital where I spent most of my formative years as a registered nurse, and I've still got a lot of peers there. And you know, so in a way, it's nothing too strange, it's nothing too different. I'll be the new girl, but I'll be amongst people I know. So it's, and whether you believe in fate or destiny or the universe or whatever, there is some that kind of element that I feel like this was meant to happen. So we'll see. I will soon let you know 6 months down the line how well it's going and if how I'm coping. But also the benefit of no not working unsociable hours anymore, just working office hours, Monday to Friday, no weekends, no bank holidays. You know, having that kind of work life balance a little bit more, maybe, you know, is kind of what I need. Little G's a bit older now, he doesn't need me as around as much, plus the fact he's in school 5 days a week anyway, so it's not going to be any, you know, any different for him. So, and I think when I did go and did these hours that I currently do, he was a lot younger. I mean, he was like one when I started my old team, so it just goes to show, doesn't it? So yeah, so that's happening. And just things like, you know, with, like I said, this underdog kind of mentality that I have, and I'm always rooting for the underdog, by the way. You know, I'm the one that kind of was very much like, you know, if you've ever seen things like Vampire Diaries and stuff, I was always rooting for Stefan. You know, Team Jacob, you know, that kind of thing, you know. So you can see where the theme's going here. You know, I always kind of like, no, I actually like these guys better, you know, like, you know, with the Supernatural, I was always Team Sam, you know. So, you know, I'm very much a rooter for the underdogs, you know. We're sadly underrated. No, but in all seriousness, I do class myself as a bit of an underdog, and that was kind of one of the themes I wanted to explore tonight, and why, really. So essentially that's kind of the buzzword for tonight's episode. So why would I class myself as an underdog? So this basically, this could go way, way back to the very, very beginning, to my very much my formative years. And it's basically, I've never really stood out. I've never really, you know, I was one of these kids. Even at like sort of high school, I wasn't naughty, I wasn't disruptive. You know, I wasn't particularly popular, but then I wasn't a hugely high achiever. So, in years down the line, bumping into ex-teachers, they, you know, seldom remember who I am, and you know, and things like, you know, old school friends and things, you know, I wouldn't even call them friends, associates maybe. So kids I would know from school. So I live one village basically outside the town I grew up in and where I went to high school. And, you know, where there's like quite a lot of people that I went to school with, obviously we're all the same age, that we're still kind of in touch maybe through social media, but don't really speak very often, but kind of nod to each other and say hello and things when we do bump into each other, you know, that's one thing. But there's like a lot of kids in my year, and you know, and although again, I wasn't a particularly a memorable student. I was kind of in the social underclass with my fellow kind of, you know, for want of a better aesthetic, the nerdy kind of alternative kind of whatever we were, the ones that didn't wear makeup, the ones that didn't do our hair, the ones that wore, you know, kind of healthcare funded specs and had, you know, braces and, you know, the hey, they worked out fine in the end. My teeth are a lot straighter now, but you know, that kind of invisibles, you know, kind of like, you know, Mia in Princess Diaries that nobody really notices she's there. And that's basically kind of how I was. Not apart from I didn't have like this mega glow up, or you know, my grandma didn't turn out to be a queen of some distant country. Though I'm sure she thinks she was. God rest her. Anyway, that's by the by. So like I was saying, like there's people that I was in the same school year as that I recognise because you know they you kind of some people just don't sort of really change. We just get a bit older and maybe a little bit rounder. And case in point, there's a girl that works at my local pharmacy who obviously I go to my pharmacy quite a lot because of my colitis meds and stuff. So it's a place I frequent every few months or so. And you know, I could go in and I just tell her, you know, can I get my you know, is my prescription ready? Blah blah blah. And it's like no recognition. And bearing in mind, I had quite a and before I got married, I had quite an unusual surname. I mean, I've double barreled it, but that's not the point. But yeah, and it, you know, a lot of it was kind of a butt of many jokes, basically, because it was quite funny. And so people kind of remembered me for that, if nothing else. And no, she, you know, didn't say, oh, you were in school, you know, nothing like that. And that's fine. That's cool. Because she wasn't a girl that I would have hung around with anyway. She wasn't a particularly nice girl in school, in fact. But, you know, we're all adults now and I hear good things about her. She's doing really well and, you know, and all the best to her, you know. I wish no ill will on anyone. And, you know, it just sort of occurred to me like things such as in like sort of my student years, for example, I was the student who wasn't a particularly high achiever. Again, quite invisible. And I was one of the students that people, you know, I did quite well on my clinical practice placements and things, but again, not a particularly memorable student. You know, whereas I like to think I make a point of remembering every single student I've ever had and trying to keep in touch with them if I can, if they want to. And again, as I qualified and things, and it's just like it was expected, like being the underdog was almost an expected thing, like the setup to failure sometimes. And particularly in my first job, my first 12 months as a qualified nurse, I worked on quite an acute ward and it was quite demanding. It was quite fast paced. It had quite high patient and staff turnover. And although it was a great experience in so many ways that I learned quite a lot of theory, I learned quite a lot of the, you know, applying that theory to practice, it was too fast paced for somebody that was fresh out of uni. Excuse me. It was too overwhelming and I made mistakes. And, you know, show me a nurse that's never made a mistake. And thankfully nothing gravely serious. But just things like forgetting certain things and and struggling. And, you know, at the time I got support. I also got kind of sent to the headmistress's office, you know, kind of attitude. But, you know, with when you're very much a conscientious person and you're an anxious person, and making mistakes in places like healthcare are not advised, because it's not a case of, you know, it's people's lives, and you know, and mistakes were made, and eventually I think there was only so much support they could give me, and I ended up getting redeployed. And I look back now and it was the best thing that ever happened, if I'm honest, in hindsight. But at the time I felt it was a punishment, and I felt that I was the underdog and that I wasn't the high achiever, the high aspiring, kind of wanting to be the head of nursing one day. That was never my plan. I always wanted to be on the floor with the patients, and I still will be, because that's in essence what a nurse is. And yeah, that was quite a massive learning curve for me as a fresh qualified nurse, and a hell of a lot of responsibility. And it was almost like I felt that it was, oh, she's made a mistake again, no shock there, she can't cope on this ward, she needs to go. And those conversations might never have happened, they may never have, but they probably did. And it was like, they, in the end, I felt like they lacked any faith in me. And lo and behold, I was redeployed to a completely different department, and I actually thrived there. I thrived, I had routine, I had support, I had more staff, I had a slower patient turnover and a slower staff turnover, and I completely changed and I grew. And I did really, really well, and I left that job after, because, you know, it was a bit, I needed more of a challenge then. But that job I will always be very grateful for, and for the people that supported me through that, because that gave me the opportunity to mature as a person, as a 20-something-year-old person, and as a junior staff nurse. And that gave me a hell of a confidence boost as a nurse. I mean, unfortunately, my confidence as a nurse and my confidence as a person are two very separate entities. Fortunately, I don't think they'll ever kind of gel together. But the confidence I have as a nurse, to me, is more important because of the nature of the work that I do. And for to be certain of what the advice and health promotion and treatment and other options that I provide to the general public is a hell of a lot more important than perhaps my self-esteem at times, you know. The correct terminology would be they are equal, but I think there is something very much about hiding behind the uniform and that sort of stepping into a role. And it's, you know, and it's a true role, and it's, I do practice what I preach, and it's very important. But I feel that I've carried the underdog traits with me the entire time. Sorry about that. I felt that my child had snuck downstairs while I was recording, and he has this habit of just appearing from the darkness and terrifying the life out of me. But no, he's fine and hopefully in bed. So, like I said, I felt like the underdog kind of traits followed me through, even when I felt more confident and self-assured in, like, sort of the other roles that I took on as a nurse, that in other departments where I actually, again, I felt I thrived, I was able to take charge, I was able to get more responsibility, you know, going on the ward rounds with the doctors and kind of, you know, having that kind of, yeah, the added responsibility and accountability as a more senior staff nurse, I still felt that I probably didn't match up to my peers in some way or other. And a big part of that, I think, is I don't take criticism very well. As constructive as it may be, I still feel like I still feel like it's almost like a personal attack. And I, as I've got older, I've realised that no, especially in the nature of the role that I do, that, you know, we learn, and nursing is very much a learning vocation, and we learn from getting things not quite right and we don't do it again. And I do find that I still felt quite hurt by constructive criticism. And I even recall being a third year student, and it was only a very minor thing, and I can't even remember what it was now. It was something like nothing like major. But my mentor at the time, who I'm still in touch with and I still hold in very, very high regard, sort of said, look, there's been a bit of a complaint. This is what's happened. I just want to make sure, you know, you don't do it again. And I don't know what it was, but it really hit a nerve to the point where, you know, when you're holding back tears. And I'd gone in to admit a patient, so it meant sort of standing with the patient and just asking, basically interrogating the patient about every aspect of their life, and feeling like I had to bite back these tears. And it was so, so hard. And it, you know, and I'm one of these people, I can't hide anything on this face. It's honestly, I can't, my, you know, whatever I'm thinking kind of displays on my face anyway. And to the point where the patient actually asked me if I was okay. And I was like, yeah, I'm fine. You know, that kind of, I'm okay. Really, really high squeaky voice. And, you know, and that was one of the things, like, I remember thinking, when I become a mentor, when I become a clinical practice mentor and have my own students, I don't want them to feel like this. And that wasn't a criticism of my mentor at the time, because she's an amazing nurse. And, you know, and the, you know, the work she's done since then, and I really admire her, and I truly, she, I'll never forget her. She was probably the best mentor I ever had. And I think the biggest thing is, I am such an avid people pleaser, and I want to make people proud, and I want to keep people happy. And, you know, and I know that's not a very good drive sometimes, because you end up not leaving much left behind for yourself. And I just remember feeling I've let her down, and the feeling of letting somebody down absolutely gets me every time. And to the point where I kind of like check up on people, and are you okay, are we okay, and, you know, and it, that's not healthy, and I realised that. And it kind of coincides with being an overthinker, being incredibly self-aware, and being empathetic, and you know, and almost like that, you know, if you want to give it a kind of a label, is being an empath. And I was on social media, just, you know, scrolling through, as you do, one evening, and there was a lady, and I totally can't remember what her name was, and even what her podcast was about. And she actually said, you know, for those of you who describe yourself as empaths, which, you know, if you want to give yourself a, I would like to think I was an empath. And I think because I'm very responsive to people's feelings and emotions, and I take them on myself, and things, I'm quite intuitive in that respect. And she said, for those of you who describe yourself as empaths, who gave you permission to basically feel other people's feelings? And it really hit me quite hard, and it wasn't like a criticism, it was a statement. And she, you know, and I sort of was like, oh, okay, because I felt like it was almost like not an attack, but almost like a criticism of people who generalize themselves as empaths or empathetic people. And she said, you're the type of person who can tell somebody's mood by the way they breathe, by the way they walk, by the way they close the door, by the way they do certain things. And she said, who did that to you? And I was just completely gobsmacked, because I can pick up on people's moods by the way they breathe, the way they walk, the way they hold themselves, and particularly my nearest and dearest, I most certainly can. And it really hit me hard to the point where I felt quite tearful. And it threw me back to years and years ago when my dad, the non-biological one, I'm just saying that quietly in case my child overhears that, the one who I consider my father, was at the peak of his depression. And those were very hard years. Those are very hard to deal with. And I think I was about 8 years old when he was diagnosed. And basically, I find it very difficult to talk about because I love him unconditionally. And blood or not makes no difference. Family's family. And it was incredibly hard. And as much as I forgive him now, he's one of very few people I actually forgive in life. He was very hard to live with for those years that he was ill. And as a young child, you know, I was barely older than my son is now. And to witness that behaviour, the atmosphere in the house when he was ill was absolutely palpable, and it was awful. It was an awful time. And it's almost like there's probably a lot of that that has had an impact on me becoming an adult. And the hard thing for me is to say it is, although it's, without sounding, it's not his fault because he was ill. But a lot, I think, of the issues that I've carried through to adulthood, there's partly been because I had a mentally ill parent and not understanding that what he was saying, doing, the way he was carrying himself, the way he would ignore us for days on end, the way he would reverse his bedtime routine so he didn't have to see us. You know, I didn't realise that that was an illness because I was so young. And I do feel, as much as I forgive him and I, like I said, I love him unconditionally and I don't wish to impart blame on him, but I think that was probably quite a large contribution to me having issues later in life. And that kind of, sort of the way that podcaster sort of said, I think she's like a social scientist. I think whether she's a sociologist or psychologist or both, or and I'm racking my brains now because I can't think what her name was, but her content just was like a punch in the chest because it was exactly how I felt when I was a young child and witnessing basically a Jekyll and Hyde kind of character. And I'll admit there were days where I was frightened of him. And, you know, we are incredibly close now. We're very open and honest with each other about our feelings. And in fact, he's probably helped me the most out of everybody into recovering with my own mental health. And I think because he's been through it himself, he's walked the dark forest himself and he's danced with the black dog himself. He's very much gone through it and he's come out the other side. And he, as everybody else does, we still have our bad days, but thankfully he doesn't have them anywhere near as bad as they used to be. And it was quite frightening coming home. And as a going into sort of my, you know, secondary school years and things, and it was hard because he was majorly depressed. He basically got medically retired from his job, And he was always the breadwinner, the man of the house. And then suddenly we're struggling. My mum's doing her, she's at university, she's getting a grant, which barely put food on the table, but we got through it, and I think if anything, the experience made us all the more grateful for where we are now. But it was hard and very trying, where he would basically, on his bad days or his bad weeks, he would sort of secrete himself away and either we used to have like a dining, like a separate reception room in our old house. He would go in there and he'd just stay on the computer and he would basically ignore us completely. And then as we moved to a different house in my teens, he would then go into the spare bedroom and again play on the computer. And then he'd wait for us to go to bed and he'd get up. So his routine was very much nocturnal and sort of completely opposite to ours because then he didn't have to talk to us. And looking back now, I thought it was more that he was avoiding us because he hated us. And it wasn't. It was more that he avoided us because he hated himself. And, as a woman in her mid-30s now, it's still very hard to talk about it because I feel like I'm betraying him or speaking ill of him because of the experiences that I had as a child. And it was illness. It was illness, and as an adult, I can understand that. And as an adult that's gone through it myself, I can understand it. He could be quite crass with what he said. He would say certain words that would kind of get to me. And I've probably mentioned this before in previous, in many previous episodes. Where he'd call me selfish. And that is probably one of the most hurtful things somebody could say to me because I know I'm not selfish. I know I'm not. If anything, I'm so selfless that I probably could do with being more selfish. And I'm getting there. As I've recovered over the last few years, I have taken the time out to be more self-caring and more self. And being self-caring and self is not the same as being selfish. It's including yourself in that love and care that you give other people. And, even then in my teens and I still found that really, really harsh because I didn't ever feel that I was a selfish person. Granted, I was probably spoiled because of the kind of toxic relationship I had with my biological father, that it was all about stuff and material and money and whatever. There was no actual core values or morals or ethics or anything in that relationship I had with him, but it was in the relationship I had with my mum and stepdad. And it was hard because there was quite possibly, he was possibly right in some senses that I was spoilt. And I was privileged, and I didn't have, I perhaps didn't see the bigger picture, but then I probably wouldn't as a teenager because you don't see past the end of your nose at that age, do you, to be fair? So, and you don't really take in things, but it would be like I'd have a hard day at school and I'd come home and have a hard day at home, and there was no kind of reprieve for me. And I was very grateful for the friends I had in high school because. And even in college, because they gave me sanctuary, basically. And I had one friend who I'm still in contact with now. She lives away now, but her mum and dad were both nurses and incredibly lovely people. And like some weekends we would go and stay at, there was four of us in total. And we would stay at her mum and dad's house. And they were just the most wholesome family. They were like your wholesome nuclear family that would, you know, just like little things. I know it sounds really, really silly, but like in the morning, her dad would, bear in mind he was an intensive care nurse for many, many years. He would put on a full spread of breakfast. They had a toast rack and a teapot and, you know, like butter, you know, like little butter tubs and everything. They had, you know, it was the most wholesome kind of family. You know, they were very much like my version of the Weasleys. You know, they were so amazing. And just things, they were just lovely people, and they still are. And I bumped into them last Christmas, and they are still such an amazing family, honestly. And, you know, they were impeccably kind and very empathetic. And I think they probably knew that my family situation was a little bit complicated at times. And they were just incredibly proud of me when I became a nurse, like when I started my nursing course at university. And I remember my friend's dad, as a student, you get sent on errands, and I got sent up to get a telemetry box. Now, a telemetry box is basically a remote cardiac monitor, which I didn't know because I was a first year student nurse and I had no idea what a telemetry was. And they said, oh, can you go upstairs to the intensive care unit and get one for us? So I was like, okay. So off I trot, and there was my friend's dad. He was on because he worked permanent nights. And he was like, oh, Lauren, it's so good to see you. He said, you're a student nurse. He said, I am so proud of you. And I was like, oh, you know, like proper Mr. Weasley, you know. And, you know, and it was very great. I was so grateful for that. And even like my best friend, who probably wasn't, you know, and I've talked about her before, that our relationship is complex. But even staying at her house for days, sometimes even weeks on end, you know, was a good reprieve. And then as I got older, my best friend used to offer me his couch to sleep on when things did get really bad at home. And I think a big part of it as well was when I took I took 12 months out of my training because of sort of not so well mental health at the time, and it changed my dad's routine. And I think a big change in routine for my dad can be a trigger point for his mental health, and I realize that now. And again, it was like, why are you still here? And you know, you need to move out, and you're coming in at all times of the night. And that wasn't actually true, because I didn't really go out an awful lot, except at uni when I lived away. But I realised that it perhaps triggered him. And also at the time, my grandmother became unwell. And then my other grandmother, the one who thought she was a royal, decided to grace us with her presence, and she ended up staying longer than expected. And I think there were a lot of dynamics issues, and she could be quite tactless at times. I don't think maliciously so. I just think she was just of that generation where, again, become quite introverted and quite self-focusing. And she, you know, there was quite a lot of upset and the families, and it set my dad off again. And that was really, really hard, because, again, I was the target again, because I never used to fight back, whereas my brother did. But I think because I'd seen the dynamics change between my dad and my brother, particularly when my brother was a teenager and had quite a mouth on him, shall we say, and it did actually get physical. And I was frightened of that. And I will admit there were times where I was frightened of him, or frightened of upsetting him, or frightened of disappointing him. And, Yes, that was more than enough reason never to fight back or answer back. Or I thought I could with my mum if my dad wasn't there. And I think looking back, teenagers do that because they know they're safe, so they can have a go at their parents because they know the parents aren't going to leave them. And I get that as an adult. And I didn't really have that outlet because of the situation with my dad being unwell. And it did get to a point where I did actually walk out the house and basically just with my handbag. And I phoned my best friend and said to him, "Look, can I stay at yours tonight?" And he said, "Yeah, mate, of course you can." And I had to kind of like then take him via a supermarket to get like a change of clothes and things, and I kept on his sofa for the night, and then luckily, then Big G moved in with a couple of lads and had his own space, so then I was able to stay there all the time then, pretty much subletting, until we got a place of our own, because I knew then the only thing that we could do was that I had to leave for the sake of my father. I had to leave the house, and I said to Big G, "I've got to move out, so you're either with me or you're not." And the rest is history. And then we ended up getting a little flat together. So, and it's that kind of people pleasing, that kind of fear upsetting people has carried me right through to the present day, essentially, where I don't like kind of even inadvertently upsetting people. I don't actually go about my day upsetting people. I don't. I really don't. But you know, and I do find that kind of underdog mentality has survived all these years, and I still feel like that's very much my place. Whether that's, you know, and that's not a self-deprecating thing. And it's not necessarily a fact, but that's just a. Something I've come to accept as I've got older, that I'm not the, you know, I'm not a kind of like the bookie's favourite, shall we say. That's a very British thing to say, isn't it? You know, I'm very much like the, and I think, you know, seeing it where I've not gone for promotions in my current role, and that was kind of a mixed feelings. Largely, it was because I wasn't in the right mindset because I was still perhaps in recovery. So the thought of taking on additional responsibilities and extra hours wasn't ideal. Plus the fact the mum guilt was a big part of that because I felt like I'd disappointed him as a parent so far that by working an extra day a week was just gonna tip me over the edge of bad parenting. This is coming from the ramblings of somebody who did not think logically at the time. So bear with me. I know that is not working full time is not an awful thing to do. This was just how I felt at the time. It was the mum guilt, the postnatal depression, the mental health, the the anxiety, everything, the colitis, everything, all kind of directing me and kind of dictating to me basically how I was thinking and feeling at the time. Also, I felt that I wasn't the in the forerunning, shall we say, that I wasn't the bookie's favourite to go for these because one position wasn't actually advertised and it was almost the, how do I put this? It was almost like I wasn't suited for the role. And that might have been because I was better at being kept as the people pleasing kind of on the shop floor grade. Which, you know, I've nothing ventured, nothing gained, and I I still believe very much that it wasn't meant to happen. I wasn't meant to go for a promotion in my current role, and that's fine, and I can live with that. And there's no bitterness or anything. And even being sort of superseded by more junior staff or more or newer staff didn't really affect me at all. So, which made me realize, made me think more to the fact that it's not a job I wanted. Sorry, I appear to start having a coughing fit then as well, so I had to kind of pause my recording. I think that plus like having three different kind of scented candles going on is probably not helping. Yeah, so I'm very much in the whether it's a measurable kind of scientific thing or not, but I do feel like sometimes things aren't meant to happen. Like sometimes things are meant to happen, you know. And for me, sometimes I did, you know, I'll openly admit that there were times where I was a little bit frustrated because I was probably, well, I say probably, I was the only member of staff, like kind of from the originals, if that makes sense, that didn't get a promotion at some stage, or didn't get any sort of career progression. And you know, and I would describe myself as I was like kind of like the all-rounder, the Swiss Army knife, the flexible kind of can be kind of put anywhere to work and I'll manage, you know. And I didn't mind that. I was, you know, kind of malleable in that sense, and I was useful, and I liked being useful because it meant that I kept people happy, and I'm a people pleaser, so it's kind of like a self-fulfilling kind of role, isn't it, really? And, you know, that probably doesn't sound very healthy either, but, you know, this is why I kind of podcast a lot about mental health. but, yeah, so it just felt right that when an opportunity like this specialist nurse role came along, that maybe it was time that I wasn't the bridesmaid anymore, and I maybe had a go at being the bride. So yeah, we'll see. And like I said, I will keep you posted on the new job and how I manage or don't manage. But I'm hoping I will manage because I've got the skills, the experience, and the kind of the mindset now that I feel so much more confident, I guess. And you know, and I was very open and honest, and sort of the whole kind of ethos of being a nurse as well, that you are open and honest about a lot of things and you keep people informed. And that was actually one of my questions on my interview was, you know, if you're struggling, how do you kind of go about it if there's something you're struggling with? And I said, I will ask for help. I'm not proud, you know, and it's a healthy thing to do. And it's a lot of, that's a kind of a, something that we all need to adopt, especially in our working lives. And I don't mean that as employees, I think I mean it as employers that, you know, seeking out and supporting. Because we're all human at the end of the day, none of us are getting out of this alive, are we? So we might as well support each other and, you know, keep each other happier and honest, and we kind of know what's going on, and when people aren't okay, it's okay. And just supporting them when they're not okay, isn't it? So yeah, so I think it's quite nice for a change that the underdog isn't currently the underdog. So, and I feel quite good about that. It's different. It's an alien concept to me. But I think, you know, and a lot of people have sort of said, you know, I think this will be the making of you. And I thought, oh, okay, grand. We'll see. You know, and it's great. But like I said, I'm really, really sad that I'm leaving the girls and boys behind. It's going to be a heck of a change. But they're still going to be there. It's just I won't be working with them. And a couple of my colleagues have actually gone back to the hospital to take up other roles anyway. So I'm kind of penciling in lunch dates as we speak. You know, so it's all good. At the end of the day, they're only a phone call away or a text away. I know where they work. I know where some of them live. So, you know, it's not like I'm going to the other side of the world or anything. I'm literally going like 2 miles up the road from my current workplace. So it's been quite a bit of a heavy one, heavy kind of going down the rabbit hole kind of discussion tonight. I say discussion, it's usually just me rabbiting on. Oh God, there's no more rabbit puns. Going on, I'm talking and chattering about random stuff. Excuse me. But yeah, so can you, this underdog mentality has kind of followed me through from kind of childhood. I've never been popular. I've never kind of wanted to be. All I've ever wanted to do is kind of make people happy and make people laugh at some time, at some stage as well. Though stand-up comedy is probably not on my agenda, because I don't like criticism. So, yeah, imagine if I get heckled, I'll just go off the stage crying. Yeah, so it is. It's good to be self-aware, and I think, like I said, now I'm in my mid-30s in a good recovery place, mental wellness-wise, that I am incredibly self-aware, but I'm also incredibly aware of others as well. And I use it to my advantage, is in terms of I know when somebody's not quite right and what can I do to help them feel a bit better. And I think that's quite an important kind of, that's an important cornerstone of the type of work I do. And if you're wondering what that big sigh was, that is my dog because she's asleep on the sofa. At least she's not sleep barking like she normally does, because that's quite terrifying, especially when you don't expect it. So yeah, she's obviously been bored to sleep by my own mumblings. So in essence, yeah, it's going to be big changes ahead. But also on a good point, and like, while we're staying positive, because we've gone through the little dark, twisty bits now, we're going to be a bit more positive now. It's mine and Big G's wedding anniversary this week. We've survived 1 year of marriage. 20 years together, but 1 year of marriage. So, yay us. I just have a feeling we've got each other the same present. So we will see. but the one he's got me looks about three times the size. So, but yeah, so basically, he's not going to listen. So I don't want him whispering because he doesn't listen to my podcast anyway. I don't think he even knows I've got one. But what I did was I got like a print, and it's you might have seen him like on the internet and stuff, but they kind of print the lyrics of your first dance, and then you can like kind of personalize like the date of the wedding and the song and the artist, and sometimes you can put like a an inset photo of, your wedding photo, whatever. And it's so the one I've got is kind of like an LP shape. If any of you know what an LP is, it's a record, a vinyl, yeah. And it's sort of got the lyrics going out sort of in concentric circles. So I've got that. So obviously it came like flat. I got like an A4 sized one because I thought I found a place on our living room wall that it can go on. But then something very similar but larger turned up the other day. So I have a feeling we've got the same gift to each other. We shall see. I'll keep you updated. I'll let you know. But we're going out for a meal next week. So only just like to a chain place, but I like familiarity and nothing too pretentious. And then we're gonna have a weekend away. So because we didn't really have much of a honeymoon last year on the account of the weather and the fact we couldn't really get time off because I'd already taken like 3 weeks off for the wedding. We'd gone up to the Lake District for a couple of days last year. So I kind of wanted to do it again this year, but prices have gone horrendously high. So we're going for a city break instead. I'm really looking forward to it. Because I want to do loads of shopping and stuff. Yeah, because I've got so much money. Not. It might likely be window shopping. Apologies, I had another coughing fit again. It's just literally because it's really drying here. So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to going. It's just something I like having things to look forward to. And it comes in, it kind of fits in really well because it's basically, it'll be my last day in my current job on the Thursday. We go away the Friday to the Sunday, and then I start my new job on the Monday. So to me, it's like a transition kind of holiday before I start my new job. And to get me over the trauma of leaving my new job, my old job, I should say. But I am really looking forward to going away. We don't get much time as a couple, very often. And usually if we do, he likes to try and take me trekking up mountains and things, and that's not really what I want to do. I want to do nice things that involve food. But he's very adventurous and I'm not so adventurous. But you know, that's why we work so well together. We're like chalk and cheese and always have been. But we have the same sense of humour, so that accounts for a lot. So yeah, so I've got a few things to look forward to. So yeah, big things are happening and you know, Colitis Mama World. So as always, I'm going to end again on a positive because that was a pretty heavy episode. Because, you know, like I say, I go down these rabbit holes and witter on endlessly. And I appreciate that some of the content, like I said in the beginning, when I put trigger warnings in, can be a little bit triggering for other people. And sometimes it can resonate with other people. And, you know, and I would hate to think that any of my content has caused anybody any distress or any upset. You know, because that's basically the very antithesis of what I aim to do with these social media platforms. So, as always, I always end up, you know, as an advocate for mental wellness and mental health, I always make sure everybody's okay. I always advise, you know, keep talking. I think it's very important being honest and open, having that trusted person that you can turn to. So whether it's a friend, a family member, a colleague, a peer, anybody that you feel trusted and able to just say to them, look, I'm not having a good day today. And just, you know, and if you've got a colleague, a friend, or a relative that's not appearing themselves, just asking them, are you okay? And having those conversations. And I think the more we do that and the more we normalize it, the better it will be. And I think, you know, there's still so much stigma and there shouldn't be. And I think if people, you know, had those open, frank conversations and said, you know, do you know what? I'm not having a good day today. I'm feeling a bit crap. I'm this, that, and the other's happening. You know, a problem shared is a problem halved. And I'm very much a believer of that. You know, and it's looking out for other people. So keep talking, keep having those conversations with people. Look out for your friends and family, you know, and seek help where need to. When you've got your GPs, your mental health practitioners, you've got, you know, there are so many charities out there, helplines, you know, some I list on my website, which I know I don't really talk about very much now, but so my website is WordPress.com/UlcerativeColitisMotherhoodandMe. And on there'll be a tab that says useful links, and there's just some charities and helplines there that I have used myself to seek some support, whether peer support or professional support during my recovery period. And I advocate those charities, absolutely amazing. So yeah, there's always somebody you can talk to, and text or email or talk on the phone, you know. I know a lot of people aren't comfortable talking on the phone, so there's text services as well. So as always, please stay safe, look out for each other, keep talking, and good night.